Welcome to the Untangling Web3 podcast. Today we have a very special guest with us, George Cassis from Kinexus. That is a bit of a tongue twister. George's blockchain journey began a decade ago with a university thesis on Bitcoin prediction models. He joined JP Morgan's custody team focusing on data analytics before moving to Kinexus, formerly Onyx, in 2019. At Kinexus, he helped launch the first tokenized asset product and now leads Web3 identity initiatives. George is a thought leader on Web3 social, identity, and privacy. And today we'll be discussing one of my favorite topics, the future of Web3 identity. George, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me. Big fan of the podcast. So yeah, thank you.
That is the reason he's here, because he's a big fan of the podcast and the only reason.
Nepotism only.
We've been trying to get George on for a while. I'm so glad this has finally happened. Like I say, this is probably one of the most important topics in my mind. We started off as a bit of a blockchain crypto podcast, and it's evolved into the wider Web3 and other topics. But I think that identity, as we'll kind of talk about, is a foundational piece and probably the most important piece on top of data authenticity. So yeah, let's jump into it. George, what is identity?
Yeah, I mean, where to start? I think let's go down the whole like Web 0, Web 1, Web 2, and so on. And I think we can see how identity has evolved over time. So in the era of Web 0, you know, no internet, brick and mortar, most of our identity lived in physical documents, papers, IDs. Everything was in files and cabinets and so on. And then over time, when Web 1 came about in the early 2000s, late 1990s, we started having very early forms of like digital identity representations in a very simple way, be it like your, you know, your Hotmail account, your username, and stuff like that. It was very static. It wasn't interactive. It was just, hey, this is my username sort of thing. And then came about, you know, Web 2 with the rise of mobile and social networks and e-commerce. And I think that gave a huge rise to our definition of what an online identity is. Because now your online identity could be your social profile. It could also be, you know, your reviews on different e-commerce sites. It could be, you know, anything of your online presence is technically your identity. The problem is that during Web 2, we've had such a boom of things from commerce to, you know, getting mortgages online through banks that internet was just not built with identity in mind. So you've had these companies that have been kind of put in a position where they found an opportunity to kind of merge or bridge the analog with the digital, which means, you know, many of us have taken, you know, pictures of our passports or pictures of our ID cards to then have a digital form of like that picture. But the original form of the document remained analog. We just put a wrapper around it and then for it to be more compatible in this Web2 ecosystem so that we can conduct business of commerce or loans or whatever. But that wasn't really the solution. That was just a Band-Aid on the problem. And we kind of saw that during COVID. I mean, during COVID, fraud rates hit an all-time high. And that's, you know, not by accident. That's because the identity system, the construct, wasn't there to basically support a fully online world.
Oh, so this is you saying because we couldn't have those physical interactions to go into a bank and put my passport next to my face, all of a sudden it became reliant on digital interactions solely, and they weren't equipped to deal with those. It was far easier to be more fraudulent.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's funny that you mentioned the whole taking a photo of, you know, your ID. I literally did that yesterday. No jokes. I got a new one. I had to use it for something immediately. And I was like, why am I still doing this? Why is this still the way? It was actually via an email as well. So that's even worse. I like that you talk about the fact that the internet was not built, or Web 1, Web 0 was not built with identity in mind. Because to a lot of people, I think, and you know, who are definitely people who were around at the time, would have said it was almost the opposite. It was almost treated as a kind of a way to do things relatively anonymously as well, right? You know, lots of the early pirating websites and stuff, for example, or, you know, the dark web, for example. There are lots of the things that people think about, and they're very much getting away from the concept of identity. They're literally trying to obscure it. And obviously we have more and more need for using identity online because we're using so many more services, so many more connected services. And now it's gone all the way from, as you said, you know, not being built with identity in mind, and now we're kind of using these single sign-on approaches where it's kind of a global identifier that you're using for everything. So what are some of, you kind of hinted at the problems there, and I think one of those people will be aware of is like all the hacks you have to do with these sensitive data sources. So what can you tell us about like that kind of problem space that we have with how it is today?
I think just going back to earlier, like, we still have to find a way of like proving ourselves again and again. Like, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I have to keep proving who I am online again and again, taking, I don't know how many pictures of my passport I've taken so far. Yeah. It's just very painful, and it's operationally inefficient, and it wasn't built again with like the user experience in mind. So I think that's kind of the crux of the problem. And if we touch a bit upon like on the solution, I think, you know, if our identity credentials were digital from the beginning, if they were part of who we are, where we can share them in a very efficient, privacy preserving way, in a way to your point where you can still prove aspects of who you are but still respect your privacy. You don't want to share all your data, you want to share a specific point so that you can do X, you know, be it like get a loan or whatever. So I think that's the future. And that's what the world is working towards, be it at a institutional level, at the government level. Yeah,
I'm glad you like you touched on the institutional and government level. And it's interesting that earlier we were talking about the social level. It's like, I guess if we were to go pre-web north, back in like prehistoric days, whatever it is, your identity would be what the people around you would say about you. It would be like a kind of a social construct where people would agree on your attributes. And then more and more, like you said, in Web Nort, it became documentation. It's what this big third party that other institutions, other individuals recognize, say the UK government, would then say about you. This person was born on this day, whatever. They have a driving license, okay. And like to Jack's point, it has become far more centralized. There are these big repositories. Even on Facebook, you have these big centralized repositories that, you know, run the effective social kind of identities for a billion people around the world. And all of a sudden, I mean, there's many problems with that in my mind. When you're solely reliant on it, obviously it's a good indicator. Facebook's very usable and everyone knows it, all this kind of stuff, and there's a lot of merit to it. But some of the downsides are that it's very inefficient going through these centralized bottlenecks. If they all of a sudden block your account, well, all that data's gone. And I think more and more, I think one of the opportunities that I kind of want to highlight is, and we were talking about this earlier, actually before the show even started, is that I think that before we get into the solution, what the solution needs to look like, one of the requirements is that we start to have an identity that is kind of more than just the aggregate of big institutions and what they say about you, but also the social element. Bring in, say, you know, my entire transaction history on Bitcoin or whatever it is. Maybe that's not a good example.
Yeah, that's not what I want as well.
Yeah, Jack definitely isn't going to be doxed that way. But it's more than just, like, the institutions are a big weight. What the UK government says you is very important. That's a strong weighted indicator. But also what my friends say about me, what, you know, reviews I have online, what NFTs I have in my Web3 wallet. I think more and more we're going to have to see these kind of two worlds of social and institutional bridge together to form one social identity. I know one social identity is a weird phrasing because if we look at W3C and all this stuff, there you can have many identities, but I think this is kind of like one of the requirements in my mind.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think the way I would frame it is, in terms of identity collection, like who you are and defining or building your own identity, that could be done in a bottoms-up approach or a top-down approach. Mm. And then the third part that I'll touch upon is the freedom for the verifier to decide. So if we start with the issuance, it could be, you know, and I know, you know, people in Web3 and all, like, we love to talk about ZK, FHE, different ways of doing identity, W3C, VC, that, DID, this.
Yeah, but all the acronyms, yeah.
Exactly. But, like, at the end of the day, it comes down to, yes, the technology needs to be there, and they're very smart people working on solving this problem. But that element of human trust, I don't think is going to go away, you know. So if it's a top-down approach, then you're going to have governments, banks, your school, your university, your, you know, whoever it is in the world as an institution, identify certain attestations about you and basically, you know, make that available for you to claim and have it in your wallet.
Yeah.
Now, if you choose to use it or how you choose to use it, that's completely up to you. But at least you have that from institutions. Now, when it comes from bottoms up, you can start having, like, in social constructs, and we can talk about later, you know, with Web3 social and your, you know, on-chain being the new online and so on, where you can have the world, your friends, kind of attest to who you are. And we're seeing that today in like with Uber, for example, you have your ratings as a customer, or like Airbnb as well. That's somewhat of an attestation of you know, you as well. But if you can have that and merge it as part of your holistic overall identity, that's quite cool.
And why doesn't that happen now? It's quite an interesting point. I have an Uber rating, I have a TripAdvisor rating, all these kind of things. Why don't you think that we're seeing those kind of things bridge over now, where I can have this kind of aggregated thing to say, okay, George wants to get a mortgage. I don't just look at his financial history. I also want to see his Uber rating to see if he's a good guy on these 100 trips he's had. Why don't we see that now, do you think?
Because it's all siloed. Everything sits everywhere. And, you know, yes, there are a few startups and platforms trying to aggregate identity together, but it's not easy. It's not real time often, and many times the commercial need to do that isn't always there.
Yeah,
so we just, you know, everything is everywhere and we're kind of just going with it.
I think that's exactly it, right? The incentives don't exist yet for, you know, you take the Uber rating example. That's it's a very illustrative example of exactly what you mean, right, of this attestation-based identity, but its limited context is limited to that context of you as an Uber driver or as an Uber passenger. And there's not necessarily a clear incentive to share that wider, right? That's partly why it stays in the silo. Because we've talked to other people on the show before about things like, I think tourism is a really good example here, right? We had a few guests last year, like Cynthia Huang, talking about industries needing to work together and open up their data silos, because you can actually unlock unseen hidden value by exposing that kind of thing, like ratings, right? So, you know, when you're going on a trip on holiday, for example, the fact that you are a trustworthy passenger might help you in three or four other downstream things on your trip, that kind of thing, or unlock local recommendations, that kind of stuff as well. So it's one of those things that is quite abstract as well. When you start talking about this, like, well, why would Uber expose my Uber rating outside of the context of Uber? But then if you think about how they're almost vertically integrating everything right now, it's food as well. They've added in the food service, and then your rating as a customer of the driving service then becomes potentially linked to your rating as a customer of the delivery service, right? If you order stuff to someone's house fraudulently, or if you're not awake or something when it gets delivered, that kind of thing. So I think, yeah, it seems like a case of incentives. Do you think that's a problem that can be addressed or is being addressed at the minute?
I think so. I think with the world of Web3, which, you know, we'll touch upon, it's trying to solve that. I think it's creating other problems as well, like multi-chain, but it's definitely trying to solve it. I think just on that as well, the number one feedback or like reaction I get from people when I describe this future world of identity, be it, you know, social or from institutions, is like, whoa, this is like very much Black Mirror, George, whatever, and so on. So I think to that I say, I agree with you. However, if the choice is yours to decide what you want to share with whom, then it should be okay. I think it comes down to decision for you owning your identity truly. Because today, like, you know, I'd be talking, like, now if we talk about a certain brand, you know, I go home, open up my social media, it's probably going to pop up as an ad.
Yeah.
How did that get there? We don't know. But that's, I think, what scares us. But if we have more control over our identity data and choose how to share it, then I think it should be okay. And the important thing as well that I want to touch upon is, like, it's also up to the verifier to decide which identity providers do they want to trust and how they want to rank that trust. Yeah. So the freedom for them to decide, that's also important. To come up with their own reputation scores based on different data points. It could be jurisdiction-based, it could be use case-based, but I think that should, you know, also be there.
You don't think about that often, actually. That's a really good point. It doesn't matter if you've got 100 different inputs. If I only care about one, because, say, it's the social example, I want to see what Jack's been posted on Facebook or something like this, or, say, like a job. I don't care about your tax history if it's a career-based kind of, you know, employment style. I care about the certificates you've got. It's very. I actually hadn't thought about that so much, that it's down to the verifier as well to say, I accept that credential you're presenting to me because I care about the input, I care about the issuer of that. Just to bring it back to, look, you talked about one of the problems right now is silos, and then you talked about one of the big misconceptions classically is that, okay, if I'm using anything blockchain or Web3, my entire history is going to be online. Jack doesn't want people knowing what he's been spending his Bitcoin on, all this kind of stuff. Can you talk about how blockchain fits into this? We've talked about the problems and a bit on the solution. How does blockchain fit into all of this?
Sure. I mean, many of us have multiple, you know, wallets and on-chain identities. I actually actively go out and start minting my own blogs and music and things just to enrich my on-chain profile.
Mm.
But that's because I choose to do so. Mm. I want to, you know, I like my on-chain profile. I think, you know, and Jesse from Base Mentions, which is like on-chain's a new online, and you know, whether that truly kicks off, you know, and how fast it takes place, time will tell. But at the end of the day, like, I want to partake in the on-chain ecosystem, so I try to have a footprint there. But equally, if you don't want that, if you just want light level proofs of something, or something that maybe is off-chain but still linked to your wallet that you own and no one can see, then you 100% should be able to do so.
Mm,
no yeah. one's saying, oh, because we're going on-chain, everyone can see everything. That will never work.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think there needs to be very careful balance of how that comes to be.
Yeah, I think if you look at the one I always go back to is, I think it's called the Sidetree protocol. It was when I first saw it years and like honestly 4 or 5 years ago now. It's bizarre how long it's been around, but it was a standard for creating digital identities, DIDs, over Bitcoin itself. And this was, I think a guy from Microsoft was working on it and proposing it, and it went through the W3C process, and then it became a kind of recognized or accepted standard. Why is it that we talk about blockchain at all, do you think, when it comes to digital identity? Because, you know, when we talked about going Web 0.1.2, we understood the problems that existed. Why is it, do you think, that it's so prevalent that blockchain is being thought of as a part of the solution? Because in theory, you can digitalize identity in other ways. You know, zero knowledge proofs and things like that can be used outside the context of blockchain. But everyone seems to think that blockchain and digital identity is this perfect marriage. So why do you think that is?
Ledger. You need a common source of truth that everyone looks at. With internet, everything is stored in different servers. But you need one source of truth. You need one place where people can point to, be it a smart contract on, you know, blockchain, to be able to, and doesn't have to be, again, your you know, identity data. It could be a hash of that identity data, or it could be a pointer. But at least you can see the timestamp, you can see who put it there, you can trust that it came from a certain identity provider. It's that common thing that people can point to. And I think in the simplest terms, like, it's that.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. So now we've talked about blockchain a little bit. But you work at JP Morgan. What? Tell us about the history of blockchain at JP Morgan. Tell us about Kinexys, the rebrand from Onyx. Like, what's going on there? It's really interesting to know that, you know, such a big company is so interested in blockchain.
Yeah, I mean, exciting stuff. Lots of things happening in the world of blockchain at JP Morgan. So I've been there for 8.5, like, yeah, over 8 years now. But I've been in the crypto blockchain space for about, you know, over 10 years, a decade. Oh, wow. And you know, when I joined JP Morgan and began to learn of our very rich history in the blockchain space and now contribute towards it, be it with Onyx and Kinexys. So the history there is, like, JP Morgan has been in blockchain, and by in the, I mean, like, researching, building, and coming up with, like, use cases and stuff that we can do since 2015.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, in 2015, we set up the Blockchain Center of Excellence. At the time, it was a small team. We were actually the first bank to open source, to build and open source the first permission blockchain Quorum. So we were the first ones to open source that, which is pretty cool. Mm. And then, you know, using that, we were able to find different use cases and, like, really solve for them using the power of blockchain and, like, working across the bank. So working with the likes of, you know, asset management and markets and also working with partners external to the bank as well. And so I think that was, you know, really, really cool. And we were able to come up with new products. So the first ones being Link, which is an information network where you have various banks and corporates around the world, mainly in, like, Asia and Africa and so on, where you're able to exchange information between each other, be it, like, sanctions and other bits of information as well, like account verification. Mm-hmm. And then came about JP Morgan Coin, which is a digital dollar. It's a representation of the US dollar on-chain. By on-chain, I mean on Quorum, on the permission blockchain.
Okay. Mm.
So it's just a representation of your cash in JP Morgan on a blockchain. So that's how it started.
Can I ask a question? Just,
please,
you said,
yeah.
What was the, can you explain, like, the, I don't know if you were part of the decision-making process, but what was the logic behind the permission blockchain? Because more and more we're talking about permissionless open blockchains now.
Yeah.
What was the kind of the ideology or the thought process behind a permission blockchain early on?
Yep, KYC and privacy.
Okay.
You know, institutions will not join or want to have transactions be exchanged between one another if the KYC, the identity and privacy part, isn't 100% solved for.
Okay, got you.
And permission blockchains at the time, and they still do, but I think now there are ways to provide or solve that problem without necessarily looking just at permission blockchain. But they provide this like kind of ring-fenced like layer that kind of protects it from the outside world of like bad actors or so on, and then still gets to benefit from, you know, the blockchain itself.
Got you. I kind of see it as like a testnet style, where you don't want to be fully exposed to everything that can happen. You're just dipping your toe in the web 2.5 of the world, and then more and more people are gaining confidence. And it kind of, the real superpower of this technology is that everyone's on the same open ledger. Everyone can verify, and I think we're starting to see that with institutions. They're moving in that direction.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I would actually want to ask, just, you know, now that we've got you here as, you know, someone from one of these institutions, essentially, who've worked so closely with permission blockchain, because, again, as you said, there are a lot of detractors about it, but clearly lots of people have also found a lot of value in using permissioned or private blockchains as well. I want to ask, in your opinion, where does the value come from? Because I think people talk about, you know, open public blockchain as having one set of very clear value propositions, I guess, right? The transparency, immutability, whether that be through proof of work or proof of stake. But clearly there is some value that many, many companies have seen in this permission approach. So where do you think the value of injecting blockchain in that context comes from there, when it's in a permission context?
I think in similar to the earlier point, I think in the permission context, there's that trust that everyone who's partaking in that ecosystem is quote unquote a good actor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that being said, you know, and happy to talk later on about Project Epic and things that we've been looking at, and also our pilot with the Monetary Authority of Singapore on public blockchain, on Polygon and Aave and stuff. Like, the future is very much looking towards a interoperable future, potentially on public, right?
Yeah.
And I think with the new technologies, with the evolution of identity, with the technologies that we're seeing within the privacy space with fully homomorphic encryption and ZK and stuff, that's starting to look more likely from happening. So, and we're already starting to see like institutions, large traditional financial institutions, getting into the public space. I think as long as you can provide that identity and privacy component, then it should be okay. Obviously, there are a ton of considerations there, but you know, that's an important part. So I think also, just going back to the whole like blockchain at JP Morgan, like the evolution, just to wrap that up. So I think in 2020, we basically rebranded from BCOE to Onyx. And, you know, yes, it's still on Quorum, and yes, it's a permission blockchain, but we did some pretty cool stuff. I mean, and we launched Onyx Digital Assets. So, you know, that was the first kind of digital assets, tokenized digital assets platform that we launched, where we tokenized US Treasuries. We then used JP Morgan Coin, which is the tokenization of cash. We then allowed or solved for the problem of how do you borrow on an intraday basis, right? So corporates and banks needed large amounts of capital for a short period of time, be it 4 hours, to make a payment, to meet an obligation. In the traditional world, they'd have to keep it on their books and pay interest overnight for that. But if you have them both tokenized, yes, it's a, you know, permission blockchain, but it still had the benefits of the blockchain itself by allowing them to borrow on a minute-by-minute basis and then unwind it by the end of the day. And to date, we've already done over $1.7 trillion of tokenized assets and cash in terms of volume. So
it's one of the bonkers things about you, your position, your company, is that you're doing these kind of like blockchain Web3 style pilot things, but when they're applied on the scale of JP Morgan, you have those kind of numbers, which is a bit bonkers, really.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why, you know, we have to do things, you know, the right way. We need to make sure that identity and all is being met, and that's why, you know, arguably our long history in the blockchain space is, I think, what puts us in a very good spot to be able to like see what the future could look like. You know, if it's on public blockchain, fine. And that's why we've done, you know, Project Epic and others, which I'll go into later. But, you know, all these learnings of the use cases, the things that we've built, can all be tangible things that we can reuse and kind of, you know, learn from going forward.
And then, so right now the focus, well, for you particularly, is identity. And why is that such a focus at Kinexys?
Yeah, you know, I think I touched upon it quite enthusiastically already, but like, I fundamentally believe that you cannot have a fully financial system on chain if you don't solve for the identity and privacy problem. Today, you are seeing funds and stuff that are tokenized on chain, but they're tokenized in a very simple, like, the underlying asset is tokenized on chain, but everything else is happening off chain.
Yeah, yeah, it's very opaque.
It's very opaque. To me, that's like version 0.001 of what the future of the financial world on chain could look like.
Okay.
If you want more complicated DeFi, like institutional DeFi protocols with different risk frameworks and different APYs and jurisdictional level kind of access points and so on, you need to have identity and privacy on chain.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability. And VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetterDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions like recycling at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at vbetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now, back to the show.
What I hear when you speak is, to me, it's a very progressive, in terms of, in Web3 terms, view, right? It's very much aligned with what I think a lot of the people who are grassroots in Web3, you know, who are building kind of from the bottom up would also be saying. I think lots of people agree with this kind of stuff. I think we agree just as enthusiasts about the space, right? And coming from JP Morgan, it's almost surprising because it's a big institution. Typically until last year, more or less, these kind of institutions have taken a long time. I've actually always thought JP Morgan were one of the companies making the right noises much earlier than lots of other people, like seeing Onyx coming so early in the cycle was, you know, I was like, wow, this is they really are trying to do proper blockchain stuff here. This is interesting. It's not just people slapping blockchain on as a term. They're actually looking and finding value in it. Are you surprised how almost the rest of the industry has pivoted in the last 12, 18 months on that? Because to me, it's been a sea change, right, that we've watched. But is it maybe not surprising to someone who's at the coalface?
No, not surprising. I think it's only a matter of time before that happened. It's very good that happens. I think things are moving in the right direction. It's exciting to see where it will lead to. My own take on this is like this year and the next year, we're probably going to see more use cases in the tokenized asset space. Yeah. So very exciting to see what comes out of all of that. But I mean, it makes sense, right? Like if you can, I think we often as a Web3 ecosystem drown in exciting terminology. You
know, real world assets.
Real world assets and, you know, and we just follow that. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to, can you generate operational efficiencies, new commercial models on chain while still meeting the regulatory and identity requirements without compromising any of that?
Yeah.
If the answer is yes, then net we're better off.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a positive sum game you're starting to play there. I think the example you gave was a really nice one, right? Is you're kind of using the shared, distributed, and always online nature of blockchains to achieve something that wasn't possible when you're reliant on, you know, human beings to do these things, right? Or kind of classically non-automated systems, but blockchain clearly provides a lot of that. I think that's an interesting one.
And we didn't get you on to have a theoretical conversation about the merits of Web3 identity. You guys are doing it. So what can you talk us through some of the pilots, you know, use cases, studies that you're actually, you know, doing right now on identity, privacy, or tokenization, everything basically. Really interesting to hear, you know, from you what you're doing, how it's affected.
Yeah, sure. So in the Onyx days, we were called Onyx Digital Identity, and then, you know, we rebranded to Kinexys, and now we're Kinexys Digital Identity. But yeah, we've been looking at identity for the past 5 years. I guess notable wins or things that I'd like to call out are, you know, we've, yes, published thought leadership articles on identity, breaking down, you know, verifiable credentials, DIDs, but, you know, also looking into the on-chain component, like soulbound tokens, NFTs as a representation of your identity, the whole social representation of your identity as well. So we published a paper in July of 2024 where we looked into the social, you know, the Web3 social aspect, like on Lens and Farcaster. Like, I'm an avid user. I love the Farcaster ecosystem personally, and you know, Warpcast and so on. And that's a big part of your identity. What you post, who you follow, all these can, you know, showcase who you are. And then in terms of like other things that we've done as well, like we open sourced our identity stack. So our verifiable credential identity code was open sourced in 2023, which is really cool because that's the second thing we ever open source as, you know, Kinexys after Quorum in 2015. So the only thing we've open sourced after that was our identity stack. And the reason we did that was realized to gain real adoption and excitement, we cannot, you know, work behind closed doors. We have to, we have to engage the developer community. And right after we open sourced the code, we led our first external hackathon in partnership with the likes of Visa, the Decentralized Identity Foundation, but equally like Lens, ZK Sync, Magic, Byconomy. So, you know, we really like meshed the worlds of Web3 and Web2, and we had 700 developers sign up to the blockchain, to the digital identity hackathon, and come up with like some fascinating use cases, be it linked to account abstraction or, you know, supply chain and healthcare. So seeing the mix of Web2 and Web3 use cases using our open source code was really, really awesome.
And what do you think that the kind of the essential step is then for that? Because we're talking about developers kind of playing around with it, building on top of it, and all this kind of stuff. Is it then to go to those hackathon style and get the small companies, say, the social media giants of the future to start adopting this? Or is it to go to governments and institutions and say, look, this works? Because like you take, to bring it back to the point earlier, there's three big parties, right? The issuers, which is institutions, maybe can be more social. The verifiers, which is a hell of a lot trickier because they're smaller parties, merchants, whatever. And then the holders as well. What's the next step to kind of get these things being used day to day?
Yeah, very good question. That's something that I think everyone in the identity space has been trying to kind of figure out and solve. I don't think there's a natural, you know, step-by-step kind of basis of how to get there. I think we just have to do everything at the same time.
Okay.
So by that, I mean governments are, you know, starting to have, you know, more digital identity kind of awareness, and be it like within Europe and EPSI and their whole specifications there on verifiable credentials, and they're seeing it more of a public good, which is really great to see. Or be it in Argentina, I know you guys had Diego over and Quark ID and all. I think that's fantastic as well. And then from a, you know, ecosystem standpoint, I think, you know, I go back to very simple models of a network. So if we think of Uber or Airbnb, and you have two-sided and three-sided markets, you're not going to get adoption if you don't have that velocity. The driver's in the right place, in the Uber use case, the driver's in the right place with the right amount of people wanting to get cabs. That needs to be perfect. And if we look at like the identity space, you can have all the identity credentials in the world, like attested, and everyone can have wallets and so on. But if you don't have the right verifiers who need that specific type of identity, then what's the point? So you need an ecosystem of trust. You need to have, let's say, if it's, you know, a financial use case specifically for, let's say, secondary markets, which we talked about in our paper, you need to then have the right transfer agents, the fund administrators. There needs to be a rule book of like what schemas of credentials will be issued to make sure that whatever you're setting up is going to be used in terms of issuing it, holding it, and verifying it.
Well, I was going to say that this is, it seems like the perennial problem of, I guess, all technology adoption, but, you know, very keenly felt in the blockchain crypto space, because there's no point everyone having a crypto wallet until you can maybe use it somewhere, right? Similar thing. There's no point everyone getting a credential if you can't have it verified somewhere. And I think the emergence of these standards, it's almost, again, back to the incentives problem. Like, yeah, you mentioned the case in Argentina, in Buenos Aires. It's one where the government is actually leading the way and saying, okay, we're willing to put in the hard graft and the investment to put out this top-down identity system, but they do want the bottom-up to add in and join to it, which is exactly, I think, how it should work. And to be honest, I think it's one of the only ways it can work is when you take a big player that, you know, takes a bold first step to do it, because they have the resources, they have the manpower to get that off the ground. But yeah, how you get these standards into the hands of many people, I just think is one of those things that is going to be a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get there.
And I think it's quite tricky because a lot of the benefits of, say, these systems and blockchain systems generally is the network effect when you get to the big adoption. So it's really hard to justify them in the short term because you don't get that. And then you kind of say, okay, is it a public service? Is it a public good? Yeah, it probably is. Like, what are some of the estimates you see that a well-implemented digital identity system could add like 7 to 15% of GDP in a lot of the Western world, which is crazy. Yeah. But say for a government to have that kind of foresight and be like, this is a 10-year roadmap of investment, very rarely happens in the Western world. One of the interesting things I think about when I first came to the idea of like Web3 identity and how it could be applied was actually around like KYC and banking KYC. The fact that, and this is probably quite true for JP Morgan because they do a lot of this stuff, is that it's very expensive to do a KYC. And every single bank I go to, every mortgage, whatever, they will do their own individual KYC. And the first question is you ask is, well, why not resell that first KYC? Why can't the party that does the first KYC resell that KYC to the second party, the third party, the fourth party? And again, it comes down to the idea of data silos, not trusting it. Who's to verify that? It's quite an important piece of information. And I thought that was a really easy first win use case where you could do it on a much smaller scale in the banking sector.
To your point, I think identity unlocks a lot of use cases and potential. Like we've talked a lot about, I guess, in the financial services space as one, and as well as the social identity space and kind of online, all the things you were talking about earlier with like Lens Protocol and stuff, taking your social graph everywhere you go online is huge. Then you've also got gaming. There's a huge application there for gaming, and that's, I think, a place where people get it. But yeah, I think that's what the thing that, why I think we've become so passionate about digital identity is that it just unlocks a lot of things that you literally can't do until it's set in stone. So having said all that about digital identity, if we could park it to the side and, you know, let's move that space away, is there anything else that's happening in kind of the Web3 emerging tech space at the minute that you think we should also be talking about and thinking about more closely?
Yeah, I mean, even in the past few months alone, we've seen such a huge wave and noise, well, some of it is good noise, about agents.
Mm. Yeah.
And using the term like Web3 and going through the whole Web0 to Web3, you have people like Outlier Ventures who have theses about, like, you know, the post-web era, and which is basically the idea that people would be using the web-less search engines, or like, you know, booking cinema tickets through search engines or going to the websites, you know, that will kind of go down and it will be kind of replaced by an agent or multiple agents, right? And that will be the main thing that we, you know, interface with. So I think that's like the next level up from Web3, which we're starting to see in, you know, very significant way, especially in the past few months.
Yeah, I've seen a lot on, I think everyone's seen a lot on agents and what their role's going to be. And I think it's right now it's very early doors. And it's like, it seems that in my mind anyway, that the progression from what most people think of as kind of AI is chatbot. And these agents are just kind of expanding their borders, like from these closed boxes that just, you know, you interact with on your screen to, okay, they can now actually interact with the internet, or they can interact and purchase, they can start to use crypto and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And when we start to get into that realm where these agents have agency and can start to actuate and do things, you start to think about, okay, how do I trust them? Like, how do I, when I interact with this agent, how do I know who they are? How do I, you know, how do I hold them accountable, for example? How can I tell they're not just being spun up by some like a rogue agent or something like that to take my money?
Yep.
And like you say, identity then comes back into it. Is it something that you're actively looking at, or is it right now just like kind of, I don't know, brainstorm to be like, okay, identity is going to be very important when it comes to this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, definitely from a thought leadership and research perspective, it's something, you know, that we are looking at. I mean, I couldn't agree more. Like, the considerations that we need to think about with agents in an agentic web are huge. Like, one thing is verifiability, which is how do you know that that agent, to your point earlier, is like truly working in an autonomous way, and there isn't a human behind the scenes who's tipping the scales and you know, to make certain decisions. How do you know that an agent who's acting in a negative way, that there are repercussions to that? Like, you know, on X, just the I think a few weeks ago, I think we saw one of the first kind of death threats issued by a bot or an agent to another human. And it went viral on X. And then in instances like that, like, who would take the blame? Who's the owner of the agent? Would that be responsible? Like, would it be the human who owns the agent who's responsible in that instance? Or, And it all ties back to identity.
Exactly, yeah. Like, well, I was going to say, I think it's not only the AI identity then, it almost forces there to be human identity because you want to link the two, right?
Yep.
If you want to move that culpability to someone else behind it as well.
It's interesting that you think we need that human identity angle, but I really do believe there will be a world where agents are spun up by agents and there's no longer a need to connect to a human to hold them accountable. It's like the classic, why don't people trust Teslas? You know, mm-hmm. they've been proven that they're less error prone than humans. It's accountability. If this Tesla car crashes into this one, okay, does that I take that one off the road, but they're all working off this hive mind, for want of a better phrase.
But there's always a human somewhere in the chain, right?
And are they held accountable?
Human zero.
I doubt the program is held accountable for that thing going wrong. I think you just say, okay, this is a liability issue. Tesla, you know, takes a hit on the price or whatever, but then you start to justify it as that's a data point. The whole system now improves from that. It's really tricky to get around this stuff. Like, I am excited, but I'm also quite worried. I think we were talking about Nexus really briefly, and he beautifully goes into the idea of, you know, bureaucrats. And right now, we trust in a system. We don't understand the system. It's very complex. So if Jack wants to prove he owns a house, then, you know, some system says somewhere that the contract he's got digitally, he owns that house. But more and more we're relying on these, you know, AI systems, and eventually it'll be agents. If all of a sudden Jack, you know, can't get his mortgage because some AI agent said so, what does that mean? How do we prove that that's the right decision? How do we understand that that's the right decision? And these models are very complicated, and I think the more complex they get, the less provability and verifiability there will be, and the less we'll trust them. It's quite scary.
It is scary. But then I think we can also see the kind of efficiencies and benefits that agents can provide for us as humans.
100%, yeah.
If we can somehow have that without the scary bit, I
think like all technology, yeah. If we could just have the ChatGPT without the existential dread.
Without the Black Mirror, yeah.
I actually have a theory I've just been kind of ruminating on recently, that because when I first heard about agents, we did an episode with Colin Fitzpatrick, and this is probably like a year and a half ago, and I was like,
early doors, yeah.
That sounds, he was way ahead of it, I think, in terms of the mainstream discussion of it. And I thought, that's interesting, I'm not sure. And then fast forward a year and a half, I'm like, okay, he was absolutely on the money. But he also was talking about identity for agents all the way back then.
Mm.
And I think at that time I was like, well, I'm not sure I can see the use for it. And over time, again, I've seen, okay, absolutely, we're going to have identity for it, but who's going to push it? I actually think it's to kind of what you were saying about us using the internet less. So much of how big companies make their money is on monitoring user behavior and how we interact with the internet. If that all gets replaced by agents, then I think the bigger companies are going to have to know that they're interacting with agents. It can't be a one-way thing, right? So I think the big companies are going to push really hard to make sure that, you know, if they are interacting with an agent, that they should know about it, in my personal opinion. And that could be what brings it through.
Proof of agent.
Yeah.
Proof of agent. Know your agent, whatever it is. But also agents knowing agents. Like if JP Morgan's agent needs to hire
an agent. Speak to your agent.
Yeah, no, it's
it's funny, but it's also probably the eventuality.
I remember watching, I think Sam Altman gave the example where, you know, an agent can call up 300 restaurants, speak to them on the phone, pretend like that agent's a human just booking in your area for you know, restaurants or dinner, which is really cool. Another aspect with agents and identity as well, which is quite hot news. Like, I think it happened this week where Story Protocol launched their developer mainnet with their public mainnet going in March. I think what's really cool about what they're doing is they want to be the IP layer for the blockchain and for agents. In the world of AI, this concept of like creative remixing is very it's everywhere. Like AIs are just utilizing information and data and publications and images that have already been created by others being humans or agents, and remixing that into something that's net new, and then using that. And with agents providing, like, for example, like Luna, one of the agents on X in December. So Luna is linked to a crypto wallet. And Luna had this, by virtuals, had this objective of hitting 100,000 followers. And Luna had the goal to hit that, the 100K, to do whatever it takes to basically get there. So Luna went on X and basically started engaging with other agents. Hey, Agent Sticks, I think, responded to Luna's request. I need a new profile pic so that I can, right. you know, shine and then get more followers and so on. And then Luna later requested for music and things like that. So Agent Sticks, let's say, was another agent that specialized in, you know, putting profile pictures or making them or generating or whatever. You know, if Agent Sticks generates it from someone else's IP and Luna then paid Agent Sticks money for that profile picture, should the people, you know, behind that, the people who own the underlying, you know, images that was used to create that, be able to get some sort of revenue? So in a world where, you know, agents on chain are starting to remix different things together, I think if you link that to payments and to IP, that could open like very interesting use cases there.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Like the world of royalties, the world of licensing, and then one agent might pay, you know, licensing fees to another agent.
Yeah, I can just feel the complexity going up though as well at the same time.
Oh,
I'm like,
my,
this is the limit of my brain thinking, okay, if you have agents firing up new agents, designing new agents to do jobs for them, and then the money, you know, how are they going to divide money? Are they going to, and they're not going to tell us, the humans, how much they made for the task?
Yeah, it's like the percentage of the economy that will be human might actually, you know, become very small. If these things are transacting in microseconds and performing things in microseconds, it kind of blows my mind a little bit.
Yeah, I think it was also Sam Altman that made a prediction that, I forgot by which year, but sometime very soon, we will have more agents than humans.
Oh yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, that doesn't.
Because if you want to, you know, I presume, again, I'm not fully versed, but I imagine hyper specificity even with agents, right? Like the more specified it is in a task, the better it'll be likely, right? Because you want to train the data. So you're going to have, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of very slightly tweaked agents for certain types of job, right? I can imagine.
What does that mean for society? Like, we're seeing it right now. I don't want to be all doom and gloom, but with, like, say, social media and so much of the activity online is attributed to bots that can be spun up instantly. And it's not that, you know, the bots just dominate the newsfeed. It's also that they start to influence humans, because if all of a sudden, you know, someone points a million bots at a particular hashtag or a particular trend, then people start to, that is the trend that gets prioritized. That's the information that gets put into our brains, and in one way or another, it begins to influence us. So it is fascinating. I think it's mostly, I imagine it's going to be positive, but there is a small part of me that is a bit scared about it and can't possibly imagine what the world's going to look like in 20, 30 years' time, maybe even 10.
It is scary. I mean, if we think back as well, or in my case, like reading back to what the world before the internet was, I think everyone was like scared, like, whoa, are we all going to be online all the time? We're all going to have these devices that we're going to be clicking the screens on. And it's scary when you think of it that way. But, you know, day by day, when we see like use cases come up and people feel more comfortable with you and realize the benefit as well, like it saves people time. Like even just booking a cinema ticket the other day, I had to go through 3 different websites. It took me 20 minutes, and then I got the date wrong, and then I had to call and like get a refund and all. I was like, I wish there was an agent that just did it, and I would pay that agent like a service fee to just do it for me. And it saves you time. You know.
And I actually like that example, because I think agents will ultimately help us reclaim some of the mental space we've lost over the last, you know, 10, 15 years from social media and how the internet's used. Because, you know, with, I love the phrase burying the lead, right? It's just this term for where you have a main point to make and then you just filibuster through it, right? And you see this constantly with articles. If you Google for an article to tell you, you know, oh, what TV channel is this football game on tonight, you'll go through about 10 paragraphs of rubbish and then they've hidden it somewhere in there. So you have to see more of their advertising and stuff. And getting an agent to go and read that article for you, synthesize it, get the information, is that's going to reclaim you like minutes upon minutes every time you go to a website. So I think it's, I 100% agree. When people start actually using them and it's not just purely abstract, we will, you know, we will start to get more comfortable with them. And every generation, they always, it's always like the older generation say, I cannot believe what the younger generation is doing. It's going to be the death of society, and then it just becomes the norm. And you know, the average quality of life tends to go up over a long time span. So
yeah,
I take it your outlook is broadly positive for the world, given what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's positive. I mean, we're definitely now in the world of like Web3 and crypto. There's a ton of innovation happening there. You know, every single day there are new hackathons across the world. There's one happening here in London in a few weeks. So yeah, I mean, most of the agents that are created will probably go nowhere. but I think they're going to be very core innovations and use cases and things that we can learn from and take forward.
Right, and on that note, I think we should wrap it up. We've covered three of my favorite topics, blockchain, identity, and AI. Thank you, George, very much for joining us. And thank you to those listening wherever you may be. And join us next time to untangle a little more of Web3.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.